From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. By the way, happy birthday to Patrick Dutton, avid Coast to Coast listener. Hope you had a great one, Patrick. Later on tonight, we'll talk about Edgar Cayce and mind power, but here's what's happening. U.S. Special Forces operations, including the unit that killed Osama bin Laden, will take part in joint military drills in South Korea to practice incapacitating North Korean leadership in case of a conflict. The U.S. Navy SEAL Team 6 will join the annual exercises between the two allies for the very first time, along with Army's Rangers, Delta Force, and Green Berets. North Korea says this is a rehearsal for an invasion. Congressional budget scorekeepers releasing their highly anticipated analysis of Republicans' Obamacare repeal bill, estimating millions of more people would be uninsured under the legislation, though the federal deficit in premiums also would shrink in the long term. The Congressional Budget Office has predicted 14 million more people would be uninsured in 2018, with that number growing to 24 million by 2026. The estimate swiftly fueled opponents' warnings that the measure would toss millions of voters off the insurance plans. We'll see what happens there. Well, if you give money to a homeless man or woman, does that make you a nice person? How often do you help somebody struggling with heavy bags, or give blood, or open the door for someone? You may consider yourself to be nice, but according to a new study, you're probably not as nice as you think. They basically say that the researchers found that people who rated themselves as nice were likely to be richer and happier, but not necessarily more pleasant. 81% of the participants, the nice ones, said, you know what? We think we're doing something right. Dr. Peter Bregan's with us. And Peter, I also wanted to talk to you about why there seems to be so much hate out there these days. What's going on?
Well, I think there's a big connection between the two things, and I actually suspect that the people who are being nice are nicer, and one of the reasons they're richer is that they work better with other human beings, because success almost always involves exchanges with other people, good relationships with other people, and, you know, just fellow feeling that gets shared. The hate business is complicated and very, very important for people to understand, well, first, what hate is.
Because I'm sensing more and more of it, Peter.
Yeah, well, I think there's more and more, but I'm getting, I don't know what your sense of it is, but I'm hearing that more and more of it is from left people who feel terribly, terribly wounded. And, I mean, you read one article after another about Trump being a hater, and he's portrayed as this really ugly, hateful man, and these are the people complaining that he's hateful. I think that there's an aspect of progressivism on the far left, and it's certainly not everybody there, where having the capacity to hate American conservatives is their big outlet when they're not feeling successful. You know, they don't hate Muslims. That's great. They don't hate terrorists. That's not so great. They don't hate anybody. They love the world. They want one world except for American conservatives.
So you think this is a left-right thing right now?
I think it's mostly coming from the left right now. The right didn't behave this way through 8 years of Obama. They didn't sit around just portraying Obama as a horrible human being and all of that that Trump is getting. So I think a lot of it is what happens if you identify your happiness with taking down somebody else. Then you're going to get profoundly depressed. When what really needs to happen on the left is for them to revive a reasonable approach to making America better that would compete with the right approach.
Interesting analysis by Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, thank you. In Clearfield, Utah, a reward offered in the search for suspects in the gruesome beating and torture of a pet cat in Utah now stands at more than $40,000. An anonymous donor just contributed $10,000. The six-year-old cat named Sage belonged to a family from Clearfield. That's north of Salt Lake City. Sage went missing a few weeks ago, was found Wednesday, died on Thursday. The Humane Society said the cat's eyes were glued shut, and someone also tried to glue parts of his body together. It had broken ribs, and its face was beaten. How sick can you get? Despite the growing alarm from the many animal rights activists and conservationists about poachers being responsible for a record slaughter in the past decade, South Africa's government is now moving ahead with plans to allow a domestic trade and limited export of rhino horns. Over the weekend, we had the full warm moon. What does that mean? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Stephen, what is that?
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. The full warm moon is actually what it's known as, because Native American cultures, as many people know, George, have always associated some magic to this particular moon, but not for the folks in the Northeast Corridor when the ground, thus the warm moon, means that temperatures are warming up. But of course, every one of the moons does indeed have a significant name, some romantic and some rather difficult to understand. But people, George, think about meteors. Who hasn't seen fireballs? And we get so many reports, as you talk about on the show and listeners call in. But people claim to also hear meteors, and they may not be, you know, off their rocker, so to speak. A new study indicating that this may indeed be true, there's two types of sounds that may be coming from meteors, and you may have heard them. One is the electrophonic effect, that is simply sound induction through the air. That kind of makes sense. But a recent study by Sandia Labs, George, talks about this thing called the photoacoustic effect. And in the simplest way we can describe it for our listeners, it's the generation of sound via light induction. And this is something that Alexander Graham Bell actually discovered back around 1880 when he developed a thing called the photophone. So simply this, if we see a meteor explode, that's called a bolide, like a fireball, it may be sending through those light waves through the atmosphere signals that are inducing and actually vibrating to cause sounds. Totally amazing, because so many people not only hear them from meteors, but also from auroras. And simply in the live sky, we talk about the western sky, folks, after sunset. Venus is the most amazing planet. Take a look at it, as we mentioned last week, in binoculars and a telescope. It moves into inferior conjunction, meaning it moves and dives in toward the sun. A beautiful sight, looking like a thin, beautiful crescent, something like sacred geometry. That is indeed important. Jupiter, rising now around 9 p.m. local time, an interesting sight. And George, maybe a sneak preview to next week. We're hoping to be on board NASA's beautiful SOFIA 747 as they search for extraterrestrial life and answers on that infrared telescope. So we're hoping to report there next week on this and so many amazing things happening. An opening of a movie coming up called Life, a science fiction horror movie. I've been asked, of course, to do a screening here in Phoenix.
Oh, great.
This movie was shot at the Shepperton Studios, George, in England, the same as Kubrick's masterpiece, the 2001 Space Odyssey. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it, George. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Talking about the skies, this is the 20th anniversary of the incredible Phoenix Lights. Can you believe this happened in 1997, 20 years ago, where thousands of people witnessed seeing something very, very strange in the sky. In a moment, Dr. Lynn Kitai joins us. She has, of course, written a book called The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone, and also she's part of the incredible documentary of the same. We will be back with Dr. Lynn Kitai in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Dory with you. As I mentioned, 20 years ago today, thousands of people in the Phoenix area witness seeing something very unusual in the sky. Late at night, a series of lights in a triangle-type pattern, very unusual. It was known now as the Phoenix Lights. I remember back then, 1997, I was heading up my Nighthawk show in St. Louis, and we heard that story, and we were covering it as well. Not being in Phoenix, little did we know just how widespread it was at the time. It turned out to be an absolutely huge story. As a matter of fact, the governor at the time, Fife Symington, kind of laughed about this, held a news conference, had somebody dress up like an alien, and came by. But he recanted sometime later. As a matter of fact, I was on the Larry King show with him when Fife Symington was there, and he said, you know what? I was wrong. There's something very unusual about that sighting. At the time, Dr. Lynn Kitai, of course, wasn't part of the Phoenix Lights, but she sure was after it got going. And here she is on Coast to Coast. Lynn, you have really done a remarkable job over these 20 years with this story.
It has become a true labor of love, I must say, and I'm so excited to visit with you again, George, and with your Coast to Coast listeners, because there is so much myth and disinformation out there, especially through the last 20 years, that so much has come to light, and I'm so excited to be able to share the true data, because, yes, I pushed my entire medical career aside, because I had a sighting up close and personal 2 years before the mass sighting, got 35-millimeter photographs of incredible anomalous aerial phenomena right outside our bedroom window. My husband, who's also a physician, and I both saw the same thing. I got pictures of it, didn't even know who to show it to, because I had no interest or knowledge in the topic at all, and wondered what this advanced technology was doing right outside our bedroom window. We live mountainside in Paradise Valley and have a panoramic view of the city skyline from our home. We're pretty high up, and one window of our bedroom, one wall of our bedroom is a window that we know what helicopters and streetlights and car lights and so forth look like, and this was quite different. These were orbs, actually oval orbs in a pyramid formation. I hope we have some time later on to get into that.
Oh, sure.
Close sighting, yep. Because they were analyzed by Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee meticulously, and he actually presented the case in 1999 to the MUFON International Symposium in Washington, D.C., His conclusion is very riveting, so I hope we can get to that. But in the meantime, I wondered for 2 years what this advanced technology was and didn't even know who to show the pictures to until 2 months before the mass sighting. And this is really important data, and anybody that's by a computer, I welcome them to go on the Phoenix Lights Network, Phoenix Lights Network website, thephoenixlights.net, and go to the photo page, because I am the only one with 35-millimeter photographs that before, during, and after the mass sighting, that I have gone to extreme lengths to have them explained to me, analyzed, authenticated at university and military levels by optical experts, and across the board, no one could tell me what they are. But in the meantime, I happened to capture the same exact mile-wide phenomena of equidistant lights that I would capture on video during the mass sighting, but this is 2 months before, and this is amazing data because I caught this thing head-on turning into a V, and it was at a distance now, and it was so unnerving not having an explanation for 95 that I called around, found the air traffic controllers at Sky Harbor International Airport who saw the same thing at the same time, and they were alarmed because they appeared over Class B restricted airspace, about 1,000 feet altitude. So they immediately looked on radar, did not show up on radar. They took their binoculars to look, and in their own words, and this is poignant because you would hear this over and over again 2 months later by thousands of people, they saw 6 points of light, totally equidistant from each other, massive span over a mile wide, that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to. And there's a 30-mile radius. Anyone that goes into that radius, especially 5 miles away, as these were, 1,000 feet altitude, they couldn't quite see what it was attached to, or there was a force field holding these orbs, these balls of light, in rock-solid formation. And one of them was a meteorologist and said that the whole thing turned as a unit against the wind. And here I am taking pictures of it while it's happening. Elevated slowly and then moved in synchrony behind South Mountain.
Very slowly, too, isn't it?
Very slowly, yeah. Right behind South Mountain, which is just south of the airport. So I said, so what was it? And there was silence. And then one of the air traffic controllers said, beats me. I said, you're air traffic controllers. You're supposed to know what's in our airspace. They ruled out every conventional possibility, every aircraft, balloons, lanterns, as well as even skydivers with lights. We kept in contact. I continued photographing these phenomena up until and including March 13th, when thousands of people were looking up at the sky purposely for a glimpse of the Hale-Bopp comet, when they also caught a glimpse of mile to 2 mile wide and even larger. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center said one of the crafts, because this is something that has come out after a 12-year compilation of thousands of reports to the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, Arizona MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, then former Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood, who was the only elected official who innocently asked for an investigation in May, and she was plastered by the media.
Oh, that I think that
picture
destroyed her political career,
no,
didn't
really,
it?
It wasn't a pretty picture, anyone that came forward in those days. But and also Village Labs, which was a computer lab near ASU, Arizona State University, that was kind of the clearinghouse for many other reports. Anyway, the conclusion was that there were 10 different craft that people saw. I'm telling you, there is so much information that unless you really look at the data, the general public, or read my book, Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Allowed to Go, on the website.
Which you've updated, too, by the way. This book is updated now.
Yes, we just came out with the 20th anniversary edition of the book. It's the third edition, 20th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights Beyond Top Secret. And I also, which I hope we get to talk about, I've been working on a curriculum for 5 years and wanted to get something out that's really fun and exciting and informative for all ages. And we just came out with the graphic novel and coloring book.
I heard about that.
Yeah, the Phoenix Lights UFOs and Crop Circles, Adventures of Sue FO Field Observer and Hugh. He's a little alien, H-U-G-H, UFO. In fact, we have such an amazing team, Mark Mankus and David Wisby and Kate Hooker, and also trying to get this together with UFO Studios, Don Garter, to actually make it interactive. But the book itself is 160 pages. It's just jam-packed.
It is. And Lynn, let me ask you, what could be one craft, or could it have been many of those lights?
That's
Let's say each light was a craft, or was it connected?
It's a great question. Well, first of all, you know, just so people can picture this in their minds, I mean, here people are seeing these formations of lights. Some people just saw formations of lights that seemed to be attached to something. Others saw actual craft go right over their heads at rooftop level. Some people said they could have thrown a rock at it. It was that close.
A huge V-shape, right?
Well, that's interesting, too. And if you look on the GAP page, G-A-P-G, Spatial Animation Project, we also have them in the coloring book, there were 10 different craft, and they're very different. Now, whether it was one craft that could morph into looking differently, or the perspective from where the person was standing, or a parade, and that's the point, because if you really look at the data, there were many things happening, and this is why there, you know, when people say there was one or two events, and it was just for a couple hours, just move forward, because it was over a dozen hours. Not only was it seen for days before by other people, including Steve Blonder, who called MUFON up to his balcony, and he happened to catch that night the arrowhead figure. You asked about the shape.
Mm-hmm.
It was V-shape, there was triangle shape, there was delta shape, there was boomerang shape, and there was even disc shape. And when you look at the data, this was starting at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. There were daylight sightings in Arizona, 5 o'clock hour in New Mexico, 7 o'clock hour in California. There's an amazing report that I have in the book of two commercial airline pilots and crew and passengers that were approaching Las Vegas, and one of these mile to 2 mile wide, and even bigger, Peter Davenport said one of them was 8 miles wide, okay, covered Las Vegas. And that's a story in itself. But at any rate, there were many things going on, orb formations as well as these craft throughout the state and beyond for over a dozen hours. Up until 5:30 is the last report that I know of personally, that I was approached by a Boeing crewman who, in detail, told me that the crew was coming in to work at Sky Harbor International Airport, and one of these crafts was hovering right over their tarmac. And the other interesting story, besides the fact that the technology, which was amazing, these crafts glided. Some of these craft glided very, very slowly and then took off at blink speed, totally silent, without even dispersing the air.
But all together, right? They came in together, they left together.
They were happening different places at different times.
Really? Like it was splitting up from the triangle?
Yes. In fact, if you look at the pictures on the GAP page on the Phoenix Lights Network website, one of them actually split in two. And two or more people had to see the same event to be able to even go into the study. And one of them split in two and then shot straight up in the air. Other people saw these orbs.
Hold on for a second, Lynn. We're at the break already. Wow, what a fast night. We'll be back with more, the 20th anniversary of the sighting of the Phoenix Lights. Welcome back. George Norrie with you with Dr. Lynn Kitai. We will take your calls next hour. We are talking about the 20th anniversary of the incredible Phoenix Lights. And it is much more than a story of lights, folks. That happened 20 years ago, believe me. So, Lynn, you were talking about how it seems like they split up and went into different directions.
Well, some of them were. There were several different kinds of crafts, whether they were V-shape or triangle or boomerang shape or even dish shape, as well as orb formations. And it's interesting. I was starting to describe some of the people saw, many of them saw these orbs detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it. I mean, the technology that we're looking at was just so unbelievable. In fact, at 8:30 that night, there was a call the next morning at 3 a.m. to the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport.
Mm-hmm.
It was all recorded, very professional. We have some of that in the documentary, so people can hear how this crewman was just elaborating on the details of one of these mile-wide craft was hovering right over central Phoenix at 7th Avenue and Indian School. And military jets were sent out with afterburners on, and there were civilians that saw this happening. And as they got closer, the lights started to dim. And as they got even closer, the whole thing just blinked out and disappeared.
Jeez.
And the crewman said that he was one of the people to help one of the pilots out of his aircraft because he was so shaken up by it. I mean, there was so much going on for over a dozen hours. And that in itself was amazing. I mean, the technology itself, that these massive things were going right over people's heads. I mean, we have pilots in the documentary that were looking up in what they called a well or canister of spinning light and energy. I mean, it just was amazing, the description. Some people saw gunmetal bottoms and windows with beings at the windows, and even more dramatic was how it affected people in real time and long term. That in itself is really interesting, and I'd love to get to how the story unfolded, because that's a whole story that really people need to hear, because that's a very, very interesting data. But just sticking to March 13th, in real time, 6 months before the mass sighting, the movie Independence Day was really popular, and we're so inundated with threat, and harm from Hollywood, from the media. How are people supposed to react when they see something really extraordinary like this coming towards them? And children, who were usually the first ones to see this, were jumping up and down, Independence Day. But as the phenomena got closer, a calmness came over everyone. A connectiveness.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that? Like the craft may have been doing it to people?
We don't know, but some people even had telepathic messages. It's a very good question. I mean, some people didn't even remember it for months or years, and then they remembered that they were given telepathic messages, not to worry. They're not here to harm us. I mean, this is really heavy. When you really
look at the data
and hear from the heartfelt and the detail that people really describe these things that have changed their life forever in real time. I mean, there was a calmness that took over everyone. In fact, the kids wanted to get in the car and follow it after it left. I mean, they were joyful. And that's what you hear over and over. People were in awe. People were amazed. They felt blessed that they were seeing this. I mean, that doesn't happen with balloons and flares, okay? But besides that, the long-term effect is really amazing because it changed people forever. I mean, people, it's not a believing anymore. It's a knowing. I mean, people were touched to the core over and over again. We can get into that discussion because it really is very poignant and part of the Phoenix Lights mass sighting. I mean, people were really, really awakened to the fact that we're not alone. I mean, it really changed people forever. We had a big event yesterday to celebrate the 20th anniversary at the Scottsdale Harkin Shea Theater. It was sold out for the 13th year. It's amazing. And we had speakers, and we showed the documentary. My collaborator, talented filmmaker Steve Lance, hosted the Q&A, and people didn't want to leave. I mean, the public is now really waking up as well, and especially the people that were there who saw the Phoenix Lights. I mean, they want answers just as I did. And after thousands of people had seen what I saw, I pushed my whole medical career aside.
Yeah, you did.
A logical source and meaning for what I witnessed in photographs.
The triangular shape, Lynn, assuming it was a craft of unknown origin, why a triangular shape?
I have no idea.
All right, that's honest.
They were triangle. They were boomerang shape. There were disc shape as well that some very credible pilot saw out in Scottsdale. They were different shapes. So, like I said, whether it was one craft that could morph into looking differently, or the perspective from where the person was standing, or a parade, which was ultimately what was the conclusion from 12 years of studying the data. And as the story unfolded, I mean, that itself is really poignant, because there was no investigation. There was no explanation for months. It was uncanny. I mean, here this is, goes even a public
publicly. Who knows what went on behind the doors, right?
Right. But in the meantime, there was nothing as far as the public was concerned until June 18th, 1997, a front page USA Today article.
With an incredible picture rendition by Tim Lay.
Exactly. It was the first time that people outside of Arizona heard about what they called the Phoenix Lights, because the videos around 10 o'clock, before 10 o'clock and after 10 o'clock, were taken over Phoenix. And we'll get to that in a second. But at any rate, on June 18th, this article really opened the Phoenix Lights up to international scrutiny. We were deluged by media overnight. I mean, it went viral, and we didn't have social media then. And every morning show, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, I mean, it was just unbelievable how in less than 24 hours it just went viral. And then we get the announcement late morning, the very next day, June 19th, that our former Governor Symington, you mentioned it at the top, announced an unscheduled press conference to reveal the culprit of the lights over Phoenix. And people took it seriously. And he comes marching out, one of his aides, in the giant alien head costume, and made a mockery of it. I mean, it wasn't a joke for the people that saw it, and he made a joke out of it, which was very disconcerting, especially parents that were with children that saw this.
Oh, right, absolutely. But he made up for it.
Well, he did. We'll get to that. Yep. We'll get to that, which was very brave, very brave. But at any rate, that really put a lid on things for a bit. And I have to tell you, I mean, I had mentioned that I pushed my medical career aside. I wanted to get to the bottom of it and find a logical explanation, any logical explanation. I saw these things up close and personal. And all I can say is it was interdimensional and it was extraordinary.
Did you talk to your husband about this, that you wanted to leave your profession to investigate?
No, it wasn't like that. I mean, I just did. I just.
I mean, you talk about gutsy, Lynn. Gutsy as anything.
He couldn't understand why I was doing it, but I really wanted to find a logical explanation, and I didn't know anything about this topic at all, which blew me away when I started finding out that this was happening worldwide, that other countries were much more open to these phenomena as being unearthly, that this has been happening since human documentation began. I mean, we can get into all that. But the more, I mean, I started keeping a journal. I mean, it's a very good question. I just started keeping a diary every day, talking to other witnesses, watching the media. I mean, there were a lot of coincidences that happened, if I can share that.
Now, as you know, though, I don't believe in coincidences.
Well, I don't either.
I think
anymore.
Everything happens for a reason.
Exactly. Well, I have been producing and working with NBC and USA Cable since 76 to disseminate vital health issues to the community. And I have my own company in 85 I formed to really get into the schools as well with video and workbook curriculums on AIDS and teen pregnancy and substance abuse prevention education. Discovery Education is distributing them as we speak for many years. And so when this fell in my lap, I really felt obliged as an educator and as a scientist to find out what was going on. And after thousands of people saw what I had been documenting for 2 years, it really sent me on a journey. And as I mentioned before, I started keeping a journal of everything. 6 months before the mass sighting, as a little aside, and it's also an important part of the whole Phoenix Lights phenomena, I was invited to present my substance abuse program at the Gila Bend Indian Reservation. It's one school, and it's situated, interestingly, between South Mountain, which is just south of the airport, and then a few miles back are the Estrella Mountain Ranges. And if you go on the photo page on the Phoenix Lights Network website, you'll see the topography where they intersect at one point. And that's where the Gila Bend Indian Reservation is, right in the basin there. Anyway, after the mass sighting, I noticed that these phenomena kept popping up right where South Mountain and the Estrellas intersected. So I called them up, and I asked them if anybody had seen strange lights on March 13th, and they started to giggle. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky people. Beings. It's part of their culture. I had no idea. I have learned so much. That was the first I had heard of it. And then, of course, when I really studied it, not only did they mention that the Estrellas, that's how it's got its name. It means star in Spanish. And the Spaniards of the day either saw these same orbs, these same phenomena, or heard the lore. But many of the indigenous cultures worldwide believe in these other intelligences, and they welcome them. In fact, they believe that they're coming to bring them knowledge and comfort and inspiration. And I've certainly been inspired by whatever these things are. But be that as it may, it's a very interesting part of the whole picture, the Native American connection. We even have Arizona Navajo Rangers, who also were speakers yesterday, who were actually investigating these phenomena, taking them seriously, which is wonderful. But at any rate, going on with the story, here, after they came out with the USA Today article, and then Governor Symington had the press conference, I wanted to get down to the bottom of this all the more, and I called every military base, and I have some of their conversations in my book, and I must say they're pretty comical, and they were just as curious as we were. And suddenly I get a call a month later, July 24th, 1997, from one of the heads of PR at the Air National Guard, and she said, oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March. And I was thrilled. I said, what were they? She said, do you believe in all these months nobody ever looked at the log for visiting Air National Guard, and the Maryland Air National Guard was in town sending off flares in Operation Snowbird, which I, by the way, later learned means diversionary tactical maneuvers, and it's certainly been a diversion ever since.
It sure was.
Whether they did it or not. And she said, that must be what some people saw. That's exactly what she said. And I said, well, wait a minute. When were they in town? She says, March 1st to the 15th. I said, were they in town in January? She says, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She said, absolutely not. I said, well, I have 35-millimeter photographs of the same exact phenomena that I took video of on March 13th, head-on, turning into a V, confirmed the next morning, both in January and the morning after the mass sighting, as appearing over Class B restricted airspace at 1,000 feet altitude. And she says, you never told me that. And then I said, besides, you're trying to tell me that flares, now let's be logical here, that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop with the wind haphazardly, have huge smoke trails that are illuminated by the flare itself, and they're meant to illuminate the area around it, which, by the way, not one person had that description that saw the true unknowns, traverse the entire state in a rock-solid, equidistantly spaced V formation for hours. And she says, I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you. Well, I'm still waiting. It's 20 years later.
No answer yet.
No answer yet. And by the way, I'm just going to interject here, too. Getting back to how it affected people, in 20 years, it's important to note, there has not been not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with
right,
the Phoenix
that's true.
Phenomena.
How did the media, local Phoenix media, handle that event that night?
That's really a great question because, interestingly, the print media was really, we're talking ridicule and skeptical and discrediting. I mean, it wasn't pretty, as I said, when Frances Barr would innocently, she didn't see it, but she was just doing her job. Many of her constituents called her and said, why isn't there an investigation? This went right over my head, even for a public safety issue. And she was plastered. However, the television media, on the other hand here, was amazing, especially one of the stations, I won't mention who, but one of the stations had a reporter who saw it. He saw one of the craft. and he wanted to get to the bottom of it. And he did amazing, amazing reports. I have a number of them in my book that really told the real story. And it's amazing how it unfolded, because then after they came out with the flare theory, of course, the witnesses and the experts that were analyzing my pictures, and again, I went to extreme lengths to have my 35-millimeter photographs analyzed at university and military level, knew that they definitely weren't flares. They didn't have any of the characteristics of flares. We were talking about craft as well, but nonetheless, that's what was out there. And it wasn't until months later, as the story unfolded, actually 3 years later, former Vice Mayor Francis Barwood was running for Secretary of State on a platform to get answers for the Phoenix Lights and asking for a reenactment, which made perfect sense. I mean, hey, if the military did it, shame on them for,
do it again.
Just ignoring it, but do it again. I mean, I'm a seer guy. You know, I got to see it to believe it, and I did see it up close and personal. But if it was military sending them off on March 13th, I know the ones that were close to me were definitely not flares. We live mountainside in a gated community, and there's no way that it was flares. Well, they were oval objects. But besides that, if March 13th, if they did send off flares, and that's what the lights were, okay, even though there were craft, which, by the way, have never been addressed, well, do it again. Well, we get an announcement right before the third anniversary that on March 8th, three Air National Guards, I believe it was New York, Michigan, and California, were going to be sending off flares to show everyone the Phoenix Lights, and we were ready, okay? And if you go to the website and you go to the middle of the page, in Arizona 3, it's a CNN affiliate report, shows what they looked like when they sent them off. Talk about a joke. I mean, they tried to make a triangle. It was upside down. It fell apart immediately. It had huge smoke trails. I mean, just what flares do. It was a dire failure for the military. I mean, they had their shot, and it really convinced the witnesses that what we had seen was definitely not flares. Now, as you move on to the story, as we know, 10 years after the fact, which is really interesting, and there's much more in between, but 10 years after the fact, the former Governor Symington actually came forward to disclose bravely that he saw one of these crafts. And as military That's right. and a pilot, it was otherworldly, and it definitely was not flares. And by the way, you know, the Phoenix Lights have never been recreated or explained. And again, the craft have never been addressed.
And when they either disappeared or took off, they blinked off, I think you said,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, some of them just blinked off. Some of them shrunk. Some of them just took off at blink speed. Some of them disappeared. I mean, the technology, and that's the other thing, George. I mean, we're talking 20 years. Have we seen anything?
Nothing. If it was ours, we'd be using it in Syria or Iraq or something.
Exactly what I say. I said with the precarious nature of everything that's happening in the Middle East and around the world, if we had this kind of technology, why wouldn't we be using it?
Exactly. Lynn, we're going to take a break. We're coming back for more, and we'll open up the phone lines next on Coast to Coast AM.